Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
I call it the podcast, Patrick. I'm still old school here.
It's the pod.
It's the pod. You like to call it the pod. You know, and here we are, you know, talking about emotional sobriety, and what a great time of year to be talking about emotional sobriety. One of the things that I'm aware of in my own life, and I see this in a lot of people that I work with and a lot of, you know, when I'm in meetings and I hear it in the rooms, is that this is a tough time of year because it's a year that a lot of expectations, you know, start to emerge and surface. And some of them we're not even aware of as we're going into the holidays that we're going to be having them. But then all of a sudden, this time of year comes around, and maybe because it's supposed to be a magical time of year, we all of a sudden start thinking that things are going to be different, and that we won't have the same conflicts in our family. We won't experience the same disappointments, that we won't go through experience some of the same patterns and habitual ways that we respond and other people respond. And, you know, people end up being very, very disillusioned and disappointed. And look, relapse during this time of year is high for those of us in recovery. I mean, this is one of those peak relapse times, because of this, you know, because that the feelings that surface touch us and touch a lot of deep, deep issues in all of us. So it's a very good time to start to talk about emotional sobriety and, you know, where these expectations come from, what they're rooted in. And more importantly is how, as Bill likes to say it, Bill Wilson said, how to unhook ourselves and this time of year, this season, from our expectations so that we can experience, you know, more emotional autonomy and not get so caught up in all of the craziness that can occur. So how to keep sane while all those around us are losing theirs? That's the topic here tonight.
Yeah.
not an easy task at all, right, Joe?
Well, I'm thinking, you know, I've got 48 Christmases to look at. And I've been through everything from being a teenager to being single to being married to having children to custody issues and parental alienation and also dealing with the whole, I don't know how much this social pressure, conformity to, you know, be it the religious or the commercial side of Christmas, you know, I have resistance to both of those things. And how do I, like, not carry the baggage of 40 out of 48 bad experiences into the expectations of this year? Like, what am I going to do to bring a curious mind, a positive regard, and just take it, you know, one step at a time when I've got this avalanche I feel or can sort of, if I dwell on it, right, it's just, oh, no, not this again. I can't wait for January 4th. So that's the thing. I've had some... You know, one of the things last year is of all of the times I dreaded the holidays, they were one day and they were way better than I thought. In fact, they were pleasant. You know, nothing bad really happened, right? And so why did I spend weeks and energy, sort of ruining? You know, it's because, once bitten, twice shy. I understand why I do that. And I'm not blaming myself for doing that. But I'm just saying I've got a choice every year. I've got a choice this year. Am I going to think I've got to buy the perfect thing for everybody? I've got to have, you know, I've got to be a Norman Rockwell type of family. Like, why would I bring that stuff when I don't have to? And what are some of the simple little things we can talk about today to just, you know, go forward, you know, instead of looking backwards? Really, that's my goal.
Patrick, how do you experience this time of year?
Well, going forward instead of looking backwards is a healthy perspective. And for me, I mean, I'm in a mental state right now where I just want to get through the holidays without incurring or causing too much damage. It's all very worrisome. I'm just having some family conflict and some relationship conflict right now. So I am fiercely chasing I'm going to try to stay present as possible in every moment, and to not veer too far ahead or behind, and to not get into too much self-pity. And I got to tell you, reaching out to others, because there's a lot of people around me in recovery spaces and otherwise who are suffering. And I've gotten a lot of mileage these last few days where I've had my own stuff by just reaching out and trying to see if I can help other people with whatever it is that they're going through, or just to listen to other people talk about themselves rather than me thinking about myself. And I'm going to be kind of in an isolated or like a geographically isolated spot the next couple weeks or the next week and a half. So I don't expect to be spending much time on the phone, though that resource will be available to me if I need it. I think stay in the moment, stay in the day, try to do the best I can with every day. Not trip on any landmines, I guess. That's where I am currently.
Yeah. You know, what you're talking about, Joe, brought me back to when I was 11 years old and my father died the day after Christmas. My mom, the day after Christmas, came out in the living room and announced to me that last night at 2 a.m., my father had passed away from cancer. And of course, I was devastated. I mean, I was devastated beyond words. I mean, I could not even articulate what I was feeling. I felt frozen inside. It was just too much for me to handle and deal with. And so, you know, ever since then, this time of year is filled with a lot of grief for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see people, families getting together. And for me, it was just for so long a reminder of what I lost. And that's been tough, man, because everybody around me, you know, wants me to be happy. They say it out of love and they say it out of kindness. They're not mean spirited in any way or dismissive. They would love to see me. But yet that grief is so rooted so deeply inside of me. And so, you know, as you know, when you have children later on, I tried to take those feelings I have, and they were juxtaposed to the excitement and to the joy I was seeing in my kids. But yet there was always that other part of what's going to happen to disappoint them, like me.
Yeah.
You know, wow. It was like that trauma was always just, it was like looming, you know, and hanging outside of the house and wondering at what point is that going to burst into our life? And now, you know, impact them and devastate them, harm them in the way that it did me. Mm-hmm. And so that, man, you know, and that's after a lot of grief work and a lot of crying about it and a lot of screaming about it and all kinds of stuff, but it was there. And, you know, what I realized is that, you know, part of what emotional sobriety is and part of what I'm trying to do in my life is to keep a sense of myself, regardless of the kind of pressures I'm getting, to feel different or to be different. That now, that doesn't mean I'm not open to changing when that's appropriate or taking feedback in and seeing if I can do something better. But I'm also well aware that everybody, you know, in our culture, you know, and I think you guys suffer from it up in Canada too, it's an all about me. You know, we make it all about us. And, you know, I know a lot of people, when they want me to be happy, it's because they're somewhat dependent on my attitude for how they feel. It's that emotional dependency again. And so there's always this pressure in terms of, or this thought that I have, is this really for me or for you in terms of how you want me to be? You want me to be cheerful so that you can be okay?
Yeah.
It was a very interesting observation Dr. Kempler made, and I'm not where he is at yet, but he was talking about crying, Jim and Patrick. He was saying that, you know, he realized that, you know, he was quite famous and gave a lot of these workshops internationally and stuff. And sometimes he'd be hitting on talking about something that would just really strike a chord of pain inside of him, and he'd start crying. And some people, you know, he was in Holland a lot and Denmark and stuff, and he had relationships that were quite, you know, well-developed over many, many years of doing these workshops and being present in those countries. And people would come up to him and start to hold him because he was crying, responsive to his pain, right? Now, let me give you a hug. And at first he would say, first he was aware, God, I really enjoyed their hug. Then he went through a period of time like, listen, I'm sorry. I'm dealing with my own pain. I can't help soothe you right now. Meaning that a lot of times the person was hugging him because he sensed that this was bringing up something inside of them that they were dealing with, and that they were going to hug him because they wanted to be soothed themselves. And then, because he was very aware of behavior being manipulative. Excuse me. Then he realized if he was really crying for the right reason, it wouldn't matter what other people were doing.
Part of like emotional sobriety is radical honesty.
Yeah.
Right? And there he's talking about just accepting where he's at today. No matter what, like, I don't need to fix me to be okay with me.
I'm a big fan of Jelly Roll, and I'm sure you probably listen to some of his tunes. And he's got this one song that's very popular right now called I'm Not Okay. I am not okay. And I love the tune. I mean, I think it's so powerful, and it's touched a lot. So many people, because what he says is, I'm not okay, and that's okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Because everything's still going to be all right. Even though I'm not okay, it's okay, because I'm still going to be all right.
Yeah.
And that, if anything, that could be a theme song for emotional sobriety.
Yeah.
Because that's what it's all about, right? It's about not being okay all the time, but being okay with not being okay. Being okay sometimes when other people feel this way and you feel different. That's okay. Even if it's unpopular, even if other people are critical of your position, that's okay. If you're disappointed, I remember one of the things for me for Christmas, you talked about going back, Joe. My mother loved Christmas. I mean, she always wanted to set up the tree and decorate it. And she was great at that stuff, you know. Italian Americans, Roman Catholics, man, they just love that time of year, right? And so we always had a festive holiday, and it was shared with family and food and, you know, a lot of great food, a lot of food and gifts and stuff. So I grew up on the northwest side of Chicago.
Yeah.
And it was a mixed neighborhood, German, Italian, a few Jews sprinkled in, but mostly German and Italian, some and Poles too, a lot of Polish people. And German. So it was very interesting all the guys that I hung out with, we liked what were called the Italian knits. So you could go down to Maxwell Street, and for $25, you'd get this beautiful Italian knit sweater from Italy, right? Yeah. $20. I mean, these were like hot.
Yeah.
Well, so when Christmas would come around, my mom would go to the Five and Dime store, Woolworths, right, which was a department store.
I remember it.
Pick up one of these golf shirts that were made out of,
like, polyester, I was going to say. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. And I remember opening this up, or opening up and getting a tie. I don't wear ties. I'm 14 years old. What the heck are you giving me a tie for? What are you giving me a polyester golf shirt for? And yet the pressure is, be grateful. You got a gift. Mm-hmm. There's kids over in China that don't have food.
Yeah.
So the pressure to give myself up and to try to conform to the expectations and be grateful for this shit-ass polyester golf shirt that I wouldn't wear, I wouldn't even wipe my ass with the damn thing. No, it wasn't that bad. But, you know, obviously I have some resentment about this that I still have not resolved.
It wouldn't be very absorbent anyway.
It would not. That's the problem with that shit. Remember polyester suits? Oh, my God. Whoever, in fact, that was the most atrocious.
No wonder everyone did cocaine. You were talking about the song, and it's okay. It just however I wake up, doesn't have to be fixed. I just need, you know, am I going to, you know, show up if I said I was going to show up? But I don't have to be the life of the party, not today necessarily. And that's emotional sobriety, is being true to all of your emotions, whatever they are, whenever they are, right? And just sort of making space for it, you know, welcome dread, welcome disappointment, you know, all that kind of thing. What Silkworth saw when he in Bill Wilson was what he called at the time a moral psychology, which in Bill Wilson, he could see someone who was losing that inward focus and worrying about the person who's suffering more. Who can he help who's in worse shape than he's in? And there's a huge opportunity in the recovery community to do that, right? Just show up at one of the, you know, sort of holiday season, 24-hour, you know, meeting-a-thons or carve turkey or clean up tables or do something to help other people who, you know, are going to guaranteed have a worse, you know, 24 hours than you're going to have. And that has healed people with addiction since we've been doing this whole sort of look at this 12-step thing. Nothing ensures our, you know, emotional sobriety more than working with another sufferer.
Well, it was interesting because I was talking about that last night when we were doing the emotional sobriety workshop, because we are on the 11th insight, which is living life with a purpose.
Yeah.
You know, living purposefully is the way I titled that chapter. And, you know, what I talked about is that there's really two, living life with a purpose really has two sides to it. It's what you're talking about, which a lot of people recognize, is giving yourself to a cause that's bigger than you deserve.
Mm-hmm.
That there's something that is very transformative about that, is that when I'm committed to the other in that way, whatever that other is, and give myself to that and do what I can to make a difference in the world, that really meets that need I have to be of value, to make a difference. Erickson even called it, later on in the last stage of life, he called generativity, is that we are concerned with the generation to come and leaving this world a little bit better than we left it, if we're going to be actualized, right?
Yeah.
If we're going to really become what we can be. But the other thing with living with a purpose is also becoming what we can be, meaning to also include the I in it. And we say that a lot. You've heard it when I do a 12-step call. I get as much out of it, if not more, than the person I'm 12-stepping. Because it always has those two dimensions to it.
Yeah.
And the self. And see, a lot of times that people don't understand that taking care of yourself in that way does not mean you're selfish. Acting for yourself without being selfish is a very important part of emotional sobriety.
Doing the right thing in the right moment. It's like, you know, 100 different options, right? If I've got young kids and I'm feeling bad, well, I'm not going to disrespect my feeling bad, but I'm going to suck it up. And I'm going to be Mr., you know, Santa Claus dad, you know, for the day, right? This healing will have to wait for another day, right? I just got to show up. And sometimes we have to just, you know, suck it up and suit up and show up, or suck it up and show up, right?
But like you said, Joe, that's the choice.
Yeah.
See, if it's a choice, then it's healthy. If it's compulsive and you do it because you don't have a choice not to, it's not good.
It looks the same, but it's very different.
Yeah. It's the same thing. And see, that's where including ourselves in that process, like you said, is making that decision. For a lot of people, you can't make a decision until you realize that you're doing things compulsively because of your anxiety and your fear. You're not doing things because you want to. It's you are feeling you pressured within yourself or outside of yourself to be a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the challenge, Patrick. Yeah, back to what you were saying. That's the challenge for each of us going into this holiday, is to not lose ourselves as we enter in this thing and find a way to stay connected to ourselves and at the same time be connected to those people that we're around.
I don't want anything from the holiday. I feel like every day I've had in sobriety where I'm able to be like 100 times more present than I was when I was loaded, and being answerable to those that I care about, and having some kind of connection to the earth. Like I feel like the expectation is often that the holidays are the time where you can really drill in on those things and, like, you know, achieve ultra presence, you know, around a roaring fireplace. But because that's been my mission statement 365 days a year, it's all a little superfluous for me. But this particular holiday, I'm just finding myself having to placate my parents and to placate my girlfriend, and they don't get along with each other, and we've all got to be together. Or that is the decision right now, is that they will all be together. And but my choice is to show up because it's meaningful to them, and just to try to, there's some circles that can't be squared, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
And God, I gotta tell you guys, it was very helpful to hear what you said about that Jelly Roll song, and just about this whole idea of I don't need to be fixed to be okay. Mentioning fathers, you know, I had a really hard call with my dad yesterday, where he basically gave me a catalog of my character defects, and the area of focus is that I have a pattern of dating broken women. This is his definition, broken women. And you know, he thinks that my current relationship is destined for ruination, and don't ruin your mother's birthday, please. My mom's birthday is this month. So when my dad talks to me like that, it's like God's talking to me like that, but that is, he's not God. He's just a guy. And he's got his own relationship problems and his own fears. And, you know, like I might resonate with half of what he said to me on the phone, but the other half I think is just projection. And so that's the work I'm doing now, is after that extremely unsettling missive going into, you know, I'm going to be traveling with my girlfriend to be with my mom for her birthday out of town for about a week on an island. This is like a horror movie. I'm going to the island, and it's something bad might happen.
Sounds like a Survivor. It sounds like a Survivor episode, doesn't it, Joe?
Yeah.
Like they're going to be on the island and we're going to give them four coconuts and see who survives.
Easily. But you know what? I'll just get dark for just a second. Like I wouldn't say I'm anywhere remotely close to a relapse, but the level of kind of like just
tension,
pain that I've got walking around with, I've just been thinking like, God, I would just drink over this. I used to just drink, you know,
because that's more to it. And look, Patrick, think about this for a minute. What if instead of going and your mission being to placate everybody, see, you're taking on a lot of responsibility. And maybe your role is instead of placating, you could do something that would be more helpful. What, you know, if, what that might be?
No, I have no idea, actually. How am I more helpful?
See, it's black and white. Either I placate or what happens?
The others are displeased.
And what happens if they're displeased? And if they're disappointed, what would that mean to you? Especially if they're disappointed in you.
Oh, well, that would mean that I've failed in some way.
Does it now?
See, that those are some of the lies we tell ourselves. What if your job was, instead of placating and making people less angry and trying to square a circle, if your job was just to accept that they don't get along and to be okay with the fact that they're not getting along and they don't see eye to eye, and that they're still showing up to be a part of something that's special for your mom?
Well, that is what I will do.
What you're doing is setting yourself up to be very responsible for everybody's feelings. And that's a lot. That's a lot. See, I was going to say, your job might be to try to stay as grounded as you can and not get lost in what everybody else is feeling, and try to be the person that you want to be in relationship to each and every one of them, regardless of what their relationship is.
My mother would like for everybody to be with her on the horror movie island for her birthday. She wants that. She does that. That's not all she wants. She wants them to arrive in a particular state and to be, you know, like, I think they would love it if I was fixed and if my relationship was fixed and that I had, you know, that I was checking all the boxes.
But what they're saying is, we don't know how to be comfortable with there being differences and with there being some tension. So we want to erase all of that. And sometimes you could be okay even if there's tension.
Well, I'll have to learn how to. I mean, I need to learn how. Yeah.
Yeah. Things are tense and I'm going to be relaxed with it.
And it's not going to be easy, man. It's I still struggle with it. I'm sure Joe does.
Yeah.
You know, I want to make people happy and I want people happy around me. But I also, when I think about it, it's a lack of faith that people can grow and learn how to deal better with situations. And so then I want to try to control it, because I don't really have a deep, deep faith that people can grow through these.
Every show that we've done together and all the other stuff, I will be bringing that in my little internal hard drive.
Bethlehem had the three wise men. All the listeners are getting here are the three wise guys.
Hey, the three wise men, me, you, and Tom.
Wise guys.
Oh, my God. Was there a bald guy in there?
I don't even know what frankincense or myrrh are. So, like,
I found a way to enjoy myself there. I mean, even though there's a lot of grief that exists right alongside all that.
Has the grief gotten any better over the years, or is it still the same raw?
You know, at times it does. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it's more intense. Last year was really brutal with the divorce and being with the kids and our families. I was alone. I was back in LA. That's the last year my ex had the children, and I was with my adult children in Los Angeles. That was tough, that separation. Sometimes the most important gifts we're going to get are not the ones we expect. And that is that if there is something that's really painful and trying and challenging for you, that there is a hidden opportunity in there to figure out what expectation did you have? What were your hopes? You know, what does that mean to you? And are you selling yourself short thinking that you need things to be a certain way to be okay? Or can you get to an okay without things being that way?
I'm going to try to have a nice time without any expectation, you know, but do my best with it.
Well, we wish all of you to have the ability to show up and not lose yourself during this holiday season.
I was going to say, we'll break on through to the other side, but that's not a Beatles song.
That's the Doors, my other favorite band.
By the way, love you guys. Love you a lot.
Tend your life, tend your myth, cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.